Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce. Happy Veterans Day. This show is dedicated to all those men and women out there who have been fighting for our freedom now and in the past. God bless you, and God bless America. And I would like to dedicate this to my very special nephew, Dominique Poisel, in the Air Force, and his father-in-law, Jeffrey Lambert, Saul Tappan, Harry Ross, Harry Goldberg, Kenneth Goldberg, my father, David Swerloff, who didn't have to go into the Marines, but he did, Bill Bagley, and my nephew, who's a staff sergeant, Robbie Ranke. To all of you and more, stay safe. Thank God you're here. And Steve Giblin is a former Navy SEAL, and John Land is here. And his book, their book, Walking in Mud, is absolutely 10 stars. So good morning and welcome, and thank you so much for doing this. I am really excited.
Thank you, Fran. Thank you for having me.
A pleasure, Fran. We're glad to be here.
John, you're the best. You know that.
But I brought a friend today. I mean, it's not just you and I. You know, we got a third person to talk to.
I am so honored that he came on today because his book really is very important. So, Steve, why did you decide to share your story? And, John, why did you decide to co-author it with him?
I felt it was an important to help convey these 10 essential qualities and how it pertains to what's happening now. You know, COVID, political upheaval, polarization, on and on.
And from my perspective, Fran, I have done a book called Overcoming. You may recall, I think we did a show on it about a year ago, a little less than a year ago. And one of the chapters in a book dedicated to overcoming adversity was on Steve, and it was on post-traumatic stress disorder. So I got to know him there, and at some point in our conversations for that chapter, he used the phrase walking in mud. And right then I saw it as a title of a book, and I knew there was a book there. And that's how it all started.
I'm glad it did. I'll tell you something. The 10 essential qualities of underworld demolition, maybe Steve will read them out afterwards or whenever he wants to read them. They're so powerful. And at the end of each chapter, he puts this there, and then he gives you the medical, mental health, and a whole bunch more that help anybody overcome anything. So, Steve, why did you decide to become a Navy SEAL and your journeys before? This was a really powerful story.
I didn't even know about the SEALs or what a frogman was. I thought they were just kind of mythical, creatures when I joined the Navy. There was what they call almost a recruiter, if you will, for the SEAL teams that was assigned to Recruit Training Command San Diego. And he actually gave us our first physical training test as new recruits. So I did very well on it, and I give that credit to my father for making sure that we were physically in shape, all throughout our life. And so this guy asked me afterwards, well, what are you going to do in my Navy? Which I also found kind of powerful. He had ownership of the Navy, and I told him what I was going to do, and he asked me if I wanted to be a SEAL. And it piqued my interest. He showed me the recruiting video, Men with Green Faces. Anybody could look it up on YouTube. And that I was hooked. I wanted it really, really bad. unfortunately,
wasn't
I had to
difficult,
go to the
though?
First.
Oh, wasn't it
yeah,
hard? The
absolutely.
Training and everything must have been horrible, really hard.
Not horrible. It was very rewarding. And I enjoyed that kind of thing. I really did. So sort of in
oh,
that artistic
wow.
way.
You are brave,
I loved
let
it.
Me tell you. So why did you focus, and I have them in front of me. And, you know, usually, Steve, when I finish reading a book and I interview the author, I give it away. I'm not giving this one away at all. Uh-uh. Because at the end of every chapter, I mean, seriously, everybody gets where they feel on their things are unfair, or they feel responsibility, or they feel sad, or they need pride. And every single one, common sense is the most important one at the end, people. Seriously. I was like, I'm reading each one of them, and then you give like a whole bunch more things at the end of each chapter that you can explain each one. So how did you come up with them? And they're so straight to the point. I love them, really.
You know, when we were looking at the structure of the book, it wasn't, uh-huh. you know, everything came organically. I think Steve would agree there. There's nothing we forced. You know, we didn't go into the project, mm-hmm. you know, with a preconceived notion of what the book was going to look like. It evolved mm-hmm. over time. And, you know, as I mentioned, the title Walking in Mud was really the thing that cued me into the fact there was a book for just that title alone. But there's actually, you know, you mentioned the 10 qualities of an underwater frogman. What really grabbed me, and what I think sets Steve's story, there's a lot that sets Steve's story apart, not the least of which on Veterans Day is 28 years mm-hmm. Serving in you know, with the Navy, the vast bulk of that in special operations in the Naval Special Warfare Division. But there was also the story of how this document came into Steve's possession. And I can't do that story justice. Steve is the one who needs to tell that story. And as soon as I heard this story, it's like, wow, this is the background for a book. There, we had to write the book after I heard this story. So I'll turn it over to Steve on that one.
Yeah, tell us about that document. That was interesting. That's what caught me, too.
Well, so when you, any one of the services, when you go into, you know, recruit training, whether it be for the Navy, Marine Corps, Army, Air Force, you learn, you know, your creed. You learn these basic, you know, rules to live by while you're in the military. And when I found this page in the old desk of my commanding officer, because he was getting a new desk as we moved into the new building, so there I was cleaning it out, and I looked at this, and I thought, wow, you know, this thing is, not only is it old, but, it, you know, and I found out the history behind it. There's plenty of old frogmen there that could tell me all of mm-hmm. this, but it was something that really stuck with me, and looking at this, and it is very simple. It is, he broke it down into mm-hmm. something that, I mean, you read it, and you're like, okay, this is how I need to act. This is how I need to behave. And of all the creeds and codes and everything that I looked up, and I really did a lot of research for myself years ago into this, this is still the one that just jumps out at me the most.
This is really great, because I love what the end it says, you know, what does it mean for you in a prescription for healing? And, you know, everybody has negative talk, and you can't listen to that. And when you wrote in, check in with yourself. Sometimes I do have to stop and think, okay, you need to restream, you need to turn it around, and you need to rethink what you're doing. And all of these, I was thinking, seriously, what would happen if you decide to put all of these 10 Frogman rules and the prescription for healing and what it means for yourself into a handbook that people could actually have and buy separately so that they could have something to help themselves with? That's just my thought for the day.
I am actually in the process, and I've already passed this on to John. It's not so much a handbook, it's a second book, but I can very easily do a handbook, and I think that's you know, that's so easy to do. It's, you know, the second book is actually called Frogman Rules, That's what I would like to call it.
Ask John what he wants to call it. I'm sure he'll come up with something else and make sure, you know, you, some of his characters are pretty strong, too. They could probably help you out.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah.
So who helps
him?
I'm going to get the second book, right? I mean, just don't leave me with the first one hanging.
Absolutely.
Oh, there's hope in the world for me. So who helps support your journey? And how, in the introduction, which I have memorized over here, did you talk about the new normal and the parallel to COVID? You and John can explain that. And how has it changed life because of it? And I really wish that virus would take a hike somewhere.
John,
When you talk about COVID, other things that have happened to this country, and you can go through any number of game-changing tragedies, you know, 9/11, Columbine. They have resulted in change, but they have not resulted in even 9/11. 9/11 would be closest to COVID in the sense that it resulted in systemic change. In everything we did, walking down the street and cameras are watching us, going through the airport took 2 hours instead of 20 minutes. Everything changed. And it was systemic, but it didn't change the way we lived from day to day. It just meant we had to get to the airport earlier. That's pretty much it. But with COVID, what we have is a paradigm shift. Nothing is going back to the way it was before COVID. That wasn't true, even with 9/11. With COVID, everything we do in our lives for the foreseeable future is going to be different, not just in our everyday interactions with trying to find stuff in stores. That's going to go away. It's going to take some time, but that's going to go away. What's not going to go away is the notion that the jobs that went away, the people who lost their livelihoods, they're not coming back. They're not coming back. The changes in office space, where people are now going to be working for, have a choice to work from home. So what does that mean? Well, it means cities are going to have all this real estate that's going to be empty. That's going to change things. People are going to be looking for a different way to live, a different place to live, because no longer are their homes going to just be places where they sleep. They're going to be places where they work, places where they live. Not just sleep. So, and the other thing I believe is that we don't even understand all the societal changes, all the systemic changes that are going to result from COVID. And the other thing COVID has done that isn't going anywhere is it has shined a bright spotlight on the divisions in this country, on the fact that everything has become political. Vaccines have become political. The disease has become political. Whether you wear masks has become political. And the great thing about our book is it addresses how you deal with that. But it doesn't take a stand. This is a book for all politics, for all cultures, all creeds, all nationalities, because what we've done with Walking in Mud, Steve and I, is we've created something that everyone can relate to. Everyone walks in mud at some point in their lives. Everybody gets bogged down by minutia, by debt, or by personal relationship issues. We're haunted. We lose what we love, and we know we can't get it back, so you're looking to replace it. How do you deal with these kind of crises? So I would say that Walking in Mud is inspired by COVID. But, friend, you just made a great point. It's not limited to COVID. It can be adapted to anyone's life and anyone's problems.
You know what's really sad is that I walk outside in the street, which is, you know, trying to get a handle on my next whatever I want to write, if I ever write anything. No one smiles. And it's like a faceless world. That's what I call it. everybody's wearing a mask, or the ones that are smart enough to want to wear a mask. You walk into some of the stores, and I go into the bakery in the morning, and I stand 10 feet away because the owners feel that because they're vaccinated that they don't need masks. And I try to explain to them, you're not immune to this thing. It's going to come back. You don't know. And I feel my heart goes out to kids, especially that they have to sit in school with a mask all day, and they don't get a chance to have the culture to go on trips, to enjoy gym, to have them. They have to eat lunches in their classroom. That's what kills me. So in page 13, see, I got this totally organized, I think. Page 13, there's lessons are listed. Know your own confidence and let people be their true selves. I wonder about that sometimes because sometimes you just, like I said, walk on the street, nobody says good morning. Nobody even knows you. And persuade through questions. How did you come up with it? How do we get people to realize that even though COVID, and it should only rot somewhere there, it bothers me because I know it's never going to go away. It's going to be here forever. How do we get people to realize that there's still people and that we're one nation and that we've got to stick together? And I know, and I can understand what you're saying about vaccines because I have family in Florida that's not vaccinated, and I had to do the hardest thing, John and Steve, that I had to do was tell them that they couldn't come here. My niece wanted to come here. She's in the music business. Her song's dropping in January. She wanted to come, and I said, you can't because you weren't vaccinated. She was invited to the MTV Awards. They told her she couldn't come because she was not vaccinated. Her mother isn't either. So I understand that. So how do you make people realize that this is so important without, you know, sticking your idea in them, but making them realize that what the president is doing, he's trying to help, not hurt?
And you couldn't have captured it better. This is something, you know, it's national security. And when people think of national security, they think of the military, they think of weaponization of, you know, certain things, or, you know, our service members overseas standing at the ready. Well, we have to stand at the ready here in the United States, in the continental United States. And to do that best, we need to make sure that we're healthy and that we have, you know, that we create resilience within the country in order for us to be able to go out and do the other things that we do in the world, you know, humanitarian aid, things like that. We need to do our own humanitarian aid.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think it's, you know, talking to people. You know, we've got, we've got people with road rage. I watched two grown men almost go to blows in the hardware store because one guy wasn't wearing a mask and the other guy confronted him on it. I witnessed this, you know, behavior that just really blew me away. And we have to take a step back and look at the greater picture and what we as Americans believe we need to, you know, how we need to move forward. And like John said, John really captured it very well. This new normal that we're in, this is it, people. We are not going back to the way that we used to be pre-COVID.
You're right. We drive through the streets here, and it breaks my heart because the pizza place that I got my pizza, the only pizza I can eat ever, went out because of
because of
Ida and because they can't afford to come back here. And they were traveling. He'd made the best pizza in the world, Felix. All the revenue pizza can't be stopped. I have gone to 10 different pizza places and only found one that uses fat-free mozzarella cheese, and the pizza's okay, not great, but it's better than nothing. I mean, that's the saddest thing in the world. There's a whole bunch of places that are out of business, and no one's putting anything in there right this minute. And it's hurtful. It's hard. And we're pretty in a nice neighborhood. Thank God the bakery didn't go out, but the bagel place got hit. So I don't know if they're ever coming back. This is sad. So how would you say quality and responsibility? How has COVID come into play for people with PTSD and then enacted? I mean, how do we make people realize that it's not going away and people are deconstructing themselves and they're not even attempting to understand that vaccination is your choice, but think about, I think there was something on my email the other day that certain places you will not be allowed in, airports and stuff, and they're trying to have also when they go into Broadway in Manhattan that kids have to be vaccinated too. So, I mean, I don't know what else. It's scary. What do we do?
So people need to understand that they have a responsibility first to themselves and their immediate circle of family and friends, and then the ripple effect is out to their community. And no matter how you feel about it, hopes or not, people are dying from this thing. We are over 750,000 Americans have died from COVID.
I know.
And the PTSD, people tend to put PTSD into a box, and that it's restricted to veterans only until something happens to them, and then they're wondering why they feel the way that they feel, and it's PTSD. And doing that self-check, and if you know somebody that is suffering from PTSD and they haven't acknowledged it, you need to help them out, because they have, getting help is so important for this.
Mm-hmm.
Checking in on friends, your personal network of friends and neighbors. And again, taking that step back and realizing what it is that this country has gone through and the world has gone through.
I know,
so,
but my brother lost three
jobs
with this thing, and he finally got one after 3 years of being out of work. He finally got something.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. It breaks my heart. He worked for an entertainment thing, and the people were kind of corrupt, so the state closed them. And he worked there, and he got COVID because they didn't wear masks and they weren't vaccinated. Fortunately, his family is vaccinated, but he kind of got a job working as a manager of some kind of big restaurant, and yet I'm afraid to go there because of all this that's going on, because everybody's everywhere. So...
Right.
My favorite part is I love the prescription for help, and like you said, focus on mental health specialists. It's hard to know the right person, that you have to feel comfortable with the right person, and you have to know that you can speak to that person freely and they're not going to repeat what you say to anyone else. And when you said to reach out to loved ones, my cousin is in the hospital because they yelled at her and I told her to go because she was really not doing well.
Yeah.
Yeah, she decided she would wanted to come here because her granddaughter's birthday is next month, and I said, but if you're dead, you can't come. So she's there now.
Right.
Hopefully they'll what do you mean? What can I tell you? So
I reached out to
what can I say, John?
Fran, I think you just made another great point, and you used the word fear. And it's one thing to be scared of what you can see and what you know.
Yeah.
It's another thing to be scared by what you don't know and what you don't see. And I think that this is people are scared of the unknown, of what's out there, where you can't – what's out there beyond the ridge, beyond the horizon. And what COVID has done is it has robbed us of certainty. It has robbed us of just being mundane, of just taking everything for granted. I mean, did we ever worry before about what we were going to find when we walked into a grocery store, what we weren't going to find? I mean, you mentioned some stores in your area that have closed. And,
a lot.
And this is the other part about the paradigm shift. How do we survive? How do small businesses, mom and pop shops, survive when they have to pay more for help or can't get help at all, when their suppliers can't deliver what they need? Because remember, Walmart and Amazon are always going to be able to get what they need because they're so big. But a little mom and pop shop that has been relying on the same couple suppliers for their furniture or their stationery, or their crystal. They've been doing these business with these suppliers forever. But now the suppliers can't get what they need to make the product. And the people who are supplying the suppliers can't get what they need to take the... So the entire supply chain, everything has been so disrupted. And when you talk about post-traumatic stress, it's kind of like whiplash. And what we have because of COVID, you know, is a nation that is that has PTSD. They may not, like Steve said, great point. You don't know what it is because you've never experienced it before. But there are tens of thousands of people in this country who are suffering from a form of PTSD that is definitely inspired by COVID.
You're 100% right. You know what's even really sadder? Is I went to call my favorite deli 2 weeks ago, and they sold it. I was in tears. And I texted the guy that owned it, and he said, we can't get the supplies, and they knew that. He said that we have to go to the supermarket to buy stuff. We can't get what we want. So there's somebody else that bought it. And it's very hard, as everybody knows, of course, whatever, to get anything. You know the only places you can get into? I called my doctor's office to ask him a question if I can come up and get something done. He said, talk to me in March. I said, you have to be kidding me. Urgent cares are overflowing. You can't even get in there to get anything done because there are like 30, 40 people coming for COVID tests every single day. Except, of course, if it's me and I call up and say, Fran's on her way, and they say, don't worry about it. No, I'm serious. It's like they figure, they're because they think I'm famous. What do I know? What can I say? But this is the one thing that I find, and I'm listening to people outside, and I can't stand the negativity. And this girl walked into the bakery the other day, and she was so pretty, and I said, my God, you look beautiful. I'm so nice to meet you. And she looked at me, she said, nobody says anything nice anymore. So why do people blame others for their mistakes? And what about people that are not getting medical tests and mammograms and stuff? And that's the truth. Because, like, I called my doctor, I needed my bloods done for whatever reason, and I went to urgent care to get it done because he said, talk to me. I said, I've been going to you for 90,000 years. So why do people, why do doctors do that? And why do people blame others for their mistakes instead of saying, yeah, I made a mistake? What's so bad about that?
Well, it's, you know, our society, that's kind of what we've become. You know, placing blame somewhere else other than, you know, owning your own mistakes and, you know, and moving on, accepting responsibility for your actions. It goes it goes a long way. It really does. It goes a long way. And, you know, geez, like you said, just even greeting people and treating people with, you know, respect and the way that, you know, they, the way you want to be treated, treating people the same way. A lot of people seem to have forgotten that.
A lot of people are just plain rude and walking in. I mean, they walk into stores and I go, you know, I'll say good morning to the pharmacist, or I'll say hi to the people behind the desk, and they'll say, hi, we're glad you're here. And then these people just, like, bark at them. And I said, do you realize that without them, you wouldn't get what you need? Maybe if
That's
they told you you can't come in here without smiling under the mask, you'd feel a whole lot better, different. I mean, seriously, I called the bagel deli. I never called them before. And I asked the girl on the phone, could you please make me these two things the way I can have them? And I went in and she said to me, no problem. Anything you need, call me at 6 o'clock in the morning and I'll have it done. And I said to her, I can't believe that there's somebody in the world that actually is so kind to do that. I was like, oh, my God, there's hope in the world somewhere. So the other thing that bothered me is that you talk about women who serve and you say don't feel sorry for yourself. There's a poor girl that's working for a construction company. I see her every morning. She's holding the pole that says slow or stop.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just standing there. Yeah, for the last 3 months, she's been saying anything slow or stop. They haven't. The guys don't talk to her. They haven't taught her anything. She's probably getting paid a lot of money to just stand there, and she doesn't smile. So how are women treated differently in the service? And you're right. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Do something about it.
My wife served 24 years in the Navy and then went on to civil service. And We both shared, you know, the privilege of serving with the one character in the book that Pete, the guy that lost his leg. He was actually her commanding officer at one point as well. And Pete was great at, even, and this was even before he ever lost his leg, one of the most stoic personalities I had ever met in my life. And, you know, if you made a mistake or you were feeling sorry for yourself, he would confront you on it and tell you, look, you got 5 minutes to feel bad about what you did or how you feel. And then you have to move on, because if you don't, you're just gonna wallow in that self-pity, and it gets you absolutely nowhere. It gets you nowhere. If you don't like your situation, move on, change it. It sounds very simple, but it sets the wheels in motion to take responsibility of your own life.
I agree with you.
I had another CO that told me one time, he asked me how it was going, and I sort of started kind of whining to him a little bit, I guess. And he stopped me midway, and he said, listen, nobody takes care of you better than you. So if you want to change this, you know, you're the only one that's going to change it. And I've lived by that, you know, for the remainder of my adult life.
But you're right. My father once said to me, look in the mirror and realize that the only person that's going to take care of you for the rest of your life is the person in the mirror, because everybody else is going to disappear after a while. And if you can't handle it yourself, then it's too bad. And he would say, and this is probably why I'm impossible to live with sometimes. I learned, if you want to know the answer to someone, get it yourself. And don't stop until you get the answer, no matter who you have to ask, no matter how many times you have to call, until you're happy with what you heard. You should have heard me yesterday.
Yes.
Seriously. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, really.
You know, friend.
I know.
What you're getting at, what Steve just opened the door to, is when you look, what made another thing that really attracted me to doing this book with Steve actually started in our very first correspondence. He sent me an email. It was a long email. Steve will remember it. He's probably smiling right now. And it was bearing his soul. And the thing that sets Walking in Mud apart from other books in this space is that every lesson, all of these 10 qualities, you know, the 10 essential qualities of the Frogman, it isn't just a list of stuff. It isn't just a how-to, a self-help, here's how to make your life better. Steve is able to relate his experiences, his own experiences and those of people he came into contact with in the SEALs in a very blunt, honest, self-effacing way. And that makes it easy for us to relate. We mentioned Pete, you know, both you met, you know, Steve mentioned Pete. Pete was an officer who lost his leg, and he wouldn't let losing his leg stop him. Not only did he continue to serve, he served as a SEAL, missing his leg below the knee, and went on to be a commander, and he was the commander. He was commanding the development group, the Green Team, when they got Osama bin Laden. So there's the commanding officer who was responsible for bringing down the greatest bad guy of our lifetimes, and he did it on one leg. My point being, if you're walking, and you know the metaphor continues, Pete was only able to walk in mud on one leg instead of two, and yet nothing stopped him. So when you look at the book, you look at examples of how not only Steve, but other people he's met along the way in the anecdotes that help make our points. These people whose life lessons are applicable to everything we're going through now. Because you know what? I think if Pete can lose a leg in a parachuting accident, as a result of a parachuting accident, and come not just all the way back, but beyond what he was before, that's the lesson, that's the model that those people, those of us or anyone out there who's struggling in this new normal that COVID has entrenched on all of us, if Pete can get by on one leg and do even better than he was before, we can deal with COVID. We can deal with whatever COVID throws at us. We just need to find the strength, the resolve, and the resilience to do it.
I think we have to remember that we're one country, too, and that what people are trying to do is exactly that, and to get over it, instead of these protests and stuff like that, where people are protesting about not wanting the vaccine or not wanting this, or this is unfair or that is unfair. I mean, think about the fact that if everyone in the whole world got vaccinated, maybe we wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. And how do we teach children how to deal with this? I mean, I think that children should read the book. I mean, teens, I think they should learn to read the book. I think they need to read the Frogman's Rules. I think they need to learn how to speak to people. I think people need to understand each other. I think fairness is great, leadership. I think sincerity. I think, really, how do you get kids to understand the message? And how do you find a mentor that you can deal with, that helps you? Because that's the hardest thing in the world. I mean, there are days I just want to scream, and I miss my sister because she's not there, and my cousin better get well because she's the one I yell to, and I'm the one she yells to. No, seriously.
Right.
My sister died 11
right.
years ago. We don't know why. My brother has his own issues, and I don't, burden anybody. But Hetty and I have been like sisters for the last 11 years since I lost mine. And how do you get a mentor, and how do you teach children that they need to get along and that it's going to be okay, and then eventually maybe you'll go to school? The governor of New York State, just said, well, maybe in a couple of months after the holiday they won't need masks. I think that's a statement that she should have waited until she was sure. What can I say?
Yes.
So what do you think?
Yes.
How do you teach kids how to deal with this? It's hard for them, I know.
It absolutely starts at home. And then, the teachers at school need to continue to carry that torch. But it's a daily routine. It is, there's no trade-offs. And having kids is, and raising kids is something that is, unfortunately for me, I was gone so much, I didn't have that daily impact that I really wanted to have on my kids. And it's true. I mean, they have to learn to, be able to, speak to somebody and take what they're saying as, as being useful and, seeing something through another person's eyes. But then those people that are talking to them, whether it be parents, a babysitter or a teacher or whomever, they also have to be non-judgmental. They, when I said earlier, people need to learn how to speak to one another and treat each other the way that they expect to be treated. That also comes from a mentor. And, I had some lapses in my life where I didn't have a mentor, and I really missed it. I didn't realize how much I missed it until I discovered another mentor. And it was a big relief. It was, having that person that you can speak to and get some truly guidance in your life or just a suggestion on how to do things, on how to take care of something. It's
You're
a
right.
special relationship. It's a very
well,
special
my aunt was that way. My aunt died. I was like, I can't believe Aunt Tommy's not here, because if you want a straight answer and you really want to know something, she would explain it the right way. And the other person was my mother-in-law, Mom Lewis. When my sister died, I had Mom Lewis, and she died right after. And I said, no, I have nobody, because my mom had Alzheimer's. And I was like, yeah, it's the hardest thing in the world. I'm wondering if for children, seriously, I taught for a long time, and I worked in a tough school in the Bronx, and my students are in touch with me on Facebook. They tell me I'm wonderful. And if they need help and they want to know something, they private message me, and I do help them. The kids, I help my nieces with their term papers and everything. But I wonder if these kids would want to write a journal about how they feel and their feelings and expressions, so they get it out and maybe even share it with their friends, or maybe teachers could have them do a journal and just to write and be able to express their feelings, even if they don't read them out loud. It's just a thought as an educator. That to me, that sounds like a great idea.
When you talk about
kids. Without a doubt, it's an outlet.
You know, I'd like Steve, you know, Steve would be better to weigh in on this, or I'd like, you know, see what Steve thinks about this. But this is what we're dealing with now, and what kids are dealing with now, what adults are dealing with now, is an incredible amount of adversity.
That's right.
You lose your sports teams. You have to wear a mask. Now it's getting better. You know, remote learning, what they've been through, losing, you know, that year of school that was lost for a lot of people, in some cases more than a year. You're not getting that year back. And here's the point I want to get at. We've raised a generation, the current generation, with you get trophies just for playing. If you fail a test, you take it again.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like what you're learning, you know, you can go to the library because you're uncomfortable. You know, there are catchphrases, and you know we're dealing at a time when parents are extremely involved in their children's education, often to the detriment of the schools and their own children. But here's what I want to get at. Have we raised, you know, these kids that we're talking about uniquely unsuited to deal with something like COVID? Because adversity for them was an option. If you lose, you win. If you fail, you succeed. That's not reality. That's not the way the world is. It wasn't the way school was when I was there. So my question, or the point, maybe it's more rhetorical, but I'd love to hear Steve weigh in. You know, are we raising a generation that is incapable of dealing with the kind of adversity that COVID has brought because they've never had to deal with any adversity before?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have not put our toe in that pool. We're hip deep in that pool, and we're realizing that the deep end is really deep. And what do we do to, you know, change this? And unfortunately, you know, we've got a generation now that is in college or even out of college now. And, you know, this particular generation, I read an article that said they will have, on average, before they retire, 10 different jobs. And because that's just the way they are. And they were encouraged to, hey, if you don't like this, just move on and go find another job. Well, that's not really dealing with adversity. And that's not dealing with a situation at hand that maybe you just don't like the way that somebody talked to you one day at work, or, you know, and it was your supervisor. You've got to be able to, you know, reflect on that and understand how you're going to deal with it. And that's what finding a mentor will do for you.
I try to encourage my niece to do that also, I agree, because she went through a lot in school, and if not for me, she wouldn't have made it through high school. Because at this particular point, you know, no one really cares. My other niece is going through college, but she has to go through remote college. They don't go in. And it sort of kills the college experience. And she's taking respiratory therapy, and I'm doing very well helping her. I'm getting really good at it. What can I say? And yeah, because the professors, you know what I'm finding? I don't know if you have kids in college. I'm finding that the professors are not teaching. They're giving these assignments, and they expect them to do the assignment, but they're not explaining how to do them. Or my favorite is the Khan Academy. Please rewrite the article in your own words, but don't use any of the words in the article or you will fail. For real. Oh, I'm serious.
This was
art and reading and something else that I had to do with her, sociology. And do not use any, don't even write the name of the article. You have to come up with a different name. And I said, what about the name of the artist, like Caravaggio or Da Vinci or whatever, that you could use, but you can't write the name of the painting. You have to write the painting discussed in the article. And we asked them all. But it took like for days to do it. I mean, seriously, how do you deal with that with remote learning? And they're basically just not even teaching. She had to do an assignment. What do you think? Why did you take respiratory therapy? And why would you turn off somebody's life support? And I said, shouldn't the teacher be discussing that in class? No. I mean, how has college education changed? Seriously. Then they're missing out on so much.
All four of my kids have gone through college, three of them have graduated college, and my youngest is actually, she left college and went to a trade school.
That's all right.
Absolutely. She's got a fantastic career now. And she, you know, but the, you know, I think that's something that's systemic throughout the higher education process, because even before COVID, you know, two of my daughters expressed that exact sentiment to me, and that is the teachers aren't teaching, they're just demanding or handing out an assignment and then not walking you through the assignment. And what are they really taking away from that? All they're really taking away is, boy, that was a really difficult assignment, you know, and I got a D on it, you know, I don't know. So this is something that even the professors in college need to understand and need to be able to walk back and say, okay, me as an educator, the impact that I have on these young adults is enormous. A lot of them don't realize that, and some of them take advantage of that. Some of them try to, you know, they use up the class time to express their political viewpoints, and if you disagree with them, you're ostracized.
Well, you have to be careful when you're writing a term paper that you have an idea of what the professor's viewpoint is. I know that from my nephew. My nephew graduated quite a number of years ago, and he's doing extremely well. And he would call me up, and he said to me, I would help him write it together, but he basically wrote it. And he had something to do with women that get attacked by men and are raped, and the professor said it's their fault. And we wrote, we wrote that it was not their fault, that, you know, why would somebody purposely ask for it? And the way the professor worded it, I said, you know what, we're going to have to write this over and come up with common ground. Then he aced it, because he had to write it over. My niece's professor, she was doing a thing on A Rose for Emily by Faulkner, and she taped what the professor said to her. This is great, but all the rest of that is blank, blank crap. And you need to do it over because you had three commas that were missing. I was like, that is not how you, right? I would soon do that, right? So, before I forget, Monday, the author of 20 Mile Show will be there. On Wednesday, somebody, John, we all know and love, Dana Perry, a.k.a. Dick Belsky, Silent Island. On the 18th, a panel show, we're going to talk about the dark side of the character. That should be fun. The 22nd, Beneath the Marigolds. And on the 23rd, I am totally honored. She writes with Patterson, Power of Attorney, Nancy Allen. What a great way. And on January 5th, I was in shock. I'm so excited. Mark Cameron, the author of Chain of Command and the Clancy series, is doing an hour with me at 12 o'clock on January 5th. What more can a girl ask for? What could I say? So, I get shocked when I get all these people and I go, like, my show is done until, like, April, so if anybody has a book coming out, let me know, because I don't normally squeeze in three shows in a week, but when it's Mark Cameron, how could I say no? Can't say no. So anybody that's going into the military, because it's Veterans Day, what would you tell them about branches of the military if they decide to go into the Army or the Navy or the Marines? Now, my father was 4F, and he went into the Merchant Marines anyway, and it was an experience. But what do you tell somebody that wants to join? Is it a good career? My nephew's going to be in for 20 years, 25 years, Robbie. And is it something that you would recommend? Would you tell them to look for something else? What would you tell somebody that wants to do?
You have to experience it for yourself. And if you decide that you like it, by all means, make it a career. If you decide you just want to do one hitch, that's great too. Life in the military, it's what you make it. It is an exclusive organization. And by the way, not everybody that goes into the recruiter's office gets accepted. It's like stepping in to an interview, but you didn't apply for that job when you went in for the interview. That first interview is with the recruiter, and the recruiters require, you know, their job is to basically conduct this interview and decide if you are able to take the next step forward. Life in the military is a completely different animal than what life in our general society is. It's service to our nation. It's a sacrifice of your time, your effort, your life. And it's a cliche, but they, you know, you do sign a blank check saying, here I am, I'm ready to go do anything and everything that my government asks of me. If you look at the list of every service member that we've lost since 9/11, the vast majority of them are in their early 20s. So our youth are who we have expended on, you know, fighting war. But that is the case in war. That is the case in war. And people need to be prepared that not only are you going into the military to just hopefully get a skill that you can bring to the outside world, you know, bring to the civilian world, you are also setting yourself up for, you know, deploying overseas, going into a combat zone.
That's right. That's what's really scary. I know. You lose people. I lost people because of COVID. My doctor's wife, my eye doctor's wife, and I used to complain to each other and text each other. He didn't even know it. And when Vera died of COVID, and it was really weird because I went in to pick up my glasses, and they said that she wasn't there. And I said, well, where is she? They said, you better get yourself tested because you were here 2 weeks ago, and she's got COVID, and I didn't know. So I did get tested. I got tested 3 times that week because they told me to, thank God. And I was with her for an hour and a half, you know, baloneying and not knowing. I knew she didn't feel it, but I realized, oh, my God, she's got COVID. When she died a month later, I felt like I lost a sister. It's horrible. So many people. So, John, what's next for you and when am I getting it? I hope.
Well, you already have Murder at the CDC.
I've got it.
And that's next, my second in the Capital Crime series. And, you know, it was interesting as an author because, and this is something we can touch on a little bit when we talk, but how much of COVID do you mention, do you include? You wouldn't have left out 9/11 from a thriller. Just make believe it never happened that the Twin Towers are still standing. It seemed to me disingenuous to ignore it, but I didn't want to focus on it because I had a sense that we'd be where we're going to be by February when the book comes out, that COVID wouldn't be in the rearview mirror, but at least it would be further back and further removed and further under control. But I think something all fiction writers are going to struggle with a bit is how do you weave the post-COVID world and the after effects of COVID into your fiction. I mean, I think it made the perfect, I think Walking in Mud because of COVID this book could have worked at any time because the problems it gets at and the people it's addressing and, you know, the advice it's providing and the life lessons it gives, they're applicable at any time. But COVID has lent a new relevance to all the things and all the points and all the themes that get raised in Walking in Mud. And I think that's true of other books in this space, like Make Your Bed by Admiral McRaven. You know, life lessons that you can live by, things that you can fall back on. So, you know, on the one hand, in my nonfiction, in a book like Walking in Mud, I think COVID has, you know, has made a book like this perfectly timed. On the other hand, for my fiction and for everyone's fiction, how do you deal with it within? People do not want to read books about COVID. They've been living it for 2 years.
No, neither do I.
You know, the last thing they want is to deal with COVID in fiction because enough is enough in fact. But we'll see.
Well, actually, if I get a murder mystery about it, I chuck it. I read one the other day before we end. That's on the Holocaust, Discovering Twins by Stella Terhart. And that's a hard one for me, too, because my grandmother was in a concentration camp, but I'm glad I read it. It was one of the most heartfelt stories to let people know that it really did happen. She has pictures of over 200 people in her family that were cremated. And she has the pictures of them before.
Gosh.
Yeah, and it was over 1,000. And somebody sent me the book. I'm telling you, they just send me these things. They don't tell me I'm going to get them. As a matter of fact, the publicist said, would you read it? But it was there that day. I said, how did you know I was going to do it? I'm interviewing her in February because that's the only time I have left. And I want everybody to know that the Holocaust really did happen and COVID really is happening, but it doesn't have to affect your personality. You have to remember that there are other positive right. things. You know, just when I'm saying to myself, why did this happen to me again? Oh, God, why did I do that? How come I got this ridiculousness again? And then I turn around and I say, you know what, it could be much worse. I'll get over it. It's okay. No problem. Seriously. I mean, my latest thing is that I pulled a muscle on my right leg. I don't know how. If I knew how to do it, I wouldn't have done it. And yesterday I said, okay, I'm going to go to...
squats or something?
What? I don't know how I did it. I know how I did it. I hate seatbelts, so I put the seatbelt under my knee and pulled the muscle. You're not supposed to put a seatbelt under your knee. And I went to physical therapy 2 weeks ago, and I walked out, and I said, never again. She addressed like 20 things I couldn't walk for 3 days. Yesterday I went to somebody, and my knee's better. And only went once.
Good.
And I was like, miracles happen. You know, you just have to think about it. You're right. So, Steve, when is your book coming out? When am I getting it? No, seriously.
December 7th. December 7th
really?
Is publication date. Yes. Yes.
Well, why do people not tell me these things? Okay.
Well, that's Walking in
I
Mud.
Have...
Are you asking about Steve's other book, Fran?
The other
oh.
one. The other one. Walking in Mud. Oh, good. I have time
oh.
to publish, post
Frogman
something.
Rules?
Yeah.
I'm hoping Frogman Rules will be maybe this time next year. I don't know yet. I have to talk to Postal Press with some help from John.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good. And, John, when is Caitlin Strong coming? Because you know I can't live without her. She's so like me. Well, I'm so like her.
Caitlin is taking some time off.
Oh, that's no fun.
We'll talk more about that in February.
Yes, we will. February 15th at 10 o'clock, people. It's in my schedule with a whole bunch more people. But this was so informative. I really wish that COVID would go away. This is dedicated, like I said, to all veterans, all women and men who have given their lives and everybody's family. But the one thing I've been saying at the end of my show, some people agree, some people disagree, but it's just me. If you see somebody and you want to say something kind. If you see somebody and you're walking in the street and they look nice, what's the deal if you say to them, where did you get that? You look lovely. I do that a lot. An act of kindness is really nice. And if we all started to do that, maybe the virus would realize you're the only negative thing in the world and would take a hike somewhere else. It would be really nice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
amen to that.
So thank you so much. Everybody, have a great day. Stay safe. Think positive. And anything that happens to you, just remember, it can only get better. Everybody have a great day. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, John. And bye.
Thanks, Fran.
Thank you.